there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your head. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there. Welcome to On the Wing Podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan. When it comes to creating bobwhite quail habitat in the southeastern United States, one of the primary goals is to open up the canopy created by trees. And the top tool for our biologist team to make that happen in the southeastern United States is prescribed fire. On today's episode of On the Wing Podcast, I'm joined by Quail Forever's Louisiana State Coordinator Jackson Martini, shaken, not stirred, of course. Quail Forever's Arkansas State Coordinator Ryan Parker and Louisiana landowner Andrew Wiesman. First of all, thank you to Purina Pro Plan once again for being the presenting sponsor of On the Wing Podcast and the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. All three of my pups, Esky, Gitche, and Winter, all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the wildlife habitat mission of our organization, which is incredibly important to me, but because Purina has a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. ProPlan was created for the working dog, the bird dog, like yours and like mine. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com. Purina ProPlan, nutrition that performs. All right. I mentioned Jackson Martini, Ryan Parker, Andrew Wiesman, the three guests for today's episode, where we go down to the Louisiana-Arkansas border. We'll start with shaken, not stirred, Jackson Martini. Anybody ever say that to you before, Jackson? I just kind of came up with that on the spur of the moment.
I get all sorts of
What's the best one?
Doug Duran at Pheasant Fest told me a pretty good joke that it takes a while to tell and it might not be super appropriate. But that might have been the best one.
All right, I guess we'll record that for the After Hours podcast.
On the Wing After Dark.
There you go. On the Wing After Dark. Bat conservation. Tell us a little bit, Jackson, about where you're from, your background, career path, a little bit, how what's relevant, and then what you do for the organization.
Sure. So I grew up in Brockway, Pennsylvania, which is a really small town in the north central part of the state. Growing up, I spent all my time outside hunting and fishing, with my dad and brother and uncles. Didn't really have much time for anything else. So when it came time to figure out what I was going to do for a living, I couldn't figure out how to get paid to hunt. So I went to Penn State instead, got my degrees in wildlife technology and wildlife and fishery sciences. And then after college, I traveled around the Midwest for a few years, working on various wildlife research projects. Most of that time was working with wild turkeys, but I did do some mourning dove, elk, and waterfowl work as well. In 2019, I joined Pheasants Forever as a farm bill biologist in Ohio. 2021, I relocated to Colorado as their senior biologist. And in June 2023, I had the opportunity to come down to Louisiana as their first state coordinator, and I thought that was a really great opportunity and challenge. There wasn't any Quail Forever biologist in Louisiana at that point, so like I said, it just seemed like an exciting opportunity. Since I got down here, we've had seven biologist positions hit the ground across the northern and central parts of Louisiana. They're all doing really great work. I think Andrew can attest to that. We have plans of adding more biologist positions in the future, expanding down into the southern part of the state.
So it's never good to talk about how somebody looks on a podcast, because most of the time people can't see it, but I'm going to make that error anyways. As I'm looking at Jackson telling his story from Pennsylvania to Ohio to Colorado, but today you look like a person that I would have profiled as living in Louisiana with a big Duck Commander beard. Have you always had the big beard, or is that to assimilate to the Louisiana kind of population of Duck Commanders?
In college, I guess my budget was stretched pretty thin, so that's when the beard came about. Shaving's pretty expensive, right?
You know, no, it's not. Shaving is not expensive.
As a broke college student, I looked at it like, you know, that's beard money. I don't need to shave. So that's how the beard came about.
And that's the lamest excuse I've ever heard for not shaving.
It's laziness is what it is, Bob. But when COVID hit, that's when I really kind of let it go. And now I only, it's about two or three times a year thing.
Andrew, you said you're a native of Louisiana. Am I completely off in my profile of Louisianans with great big Duck Commander beards? Is that just, I've been fooled by television?
It's become a thing, I would say. Everybody back home in Monroe has some sort of facial hair. So yeah.
we'll jump to you, Andrew, as our kind of our featured guest, the landowner in Louisiana. Tell us a little bit about your backstory.
Sure. So I grew up in Monroe, Louisiana. Traditionally just duck hunting as a kid, doing some deer hunting. I actually went to boarding school up in Philadelphia area, then moved on down to Dallas for college. After graduating from SMU in 2008, I moved up to Illinois, and that's when I started to get into the upland hunting. I lived up there for 15 years before moving to where I live now in Dallas, Texas, to kind of get back to the south, to move closer to Louisiana, mm-hmm. to where I can manage this property a little bit easier. I'm in the real estate world, so to an extent, I can combine my passion for the outdoors with owning real estate and managing real estate. It kind of goes hand in hand. You know, it's a different type of real estate asset class, but you know, you can take similarities from, say, my industrial background to managing recreational land as well. Mm-hmm. So I get to mix my two passions, which is, you know, something that's pretty unique, I would say.
Well, we're going to talk a lot on this episode about your property and what you're trying to accomplish and your wildlife goals. I am curious, you mentioned you kind of got connected to the uplands when you're in Illinois. Maybe explain a little further. You're growing up in Louisiana. Did you duck hunt? Did you do other things? And then explain what happened in Illinois that pulled you into the uplands.
Sure. So between 2014 to say 2020, I was running an outfitter business out of my property in Northeast Louisiana, waterfowl outfitting business. And living in Illinois, I started to hunt the upland birds a little bit. And it was really around a dog is what this turned into, Bob. I didn't want a lab, which everybody down south is a lab guy, right? Because that's what duck hunters use, mm-hmm. for the most part. But living in Illinois, hunting in Wisconsin and elsewhere, I wanted a pointer. And a buddy of mine actually told me to look into a griff. So I started researching griffs, learning the versatility of that dog, you know, they're supposedly the four-wheeler of bird dogs. And I found a lady in Arkansas, actually, that was breeding these dogs. And I was living in Louisiana for the winter, waterfowl guiding. And I drove up to Arkansas to meet this breeder. And I traded her a couple of duck hunts in order for me to pick the first of the litter. And so that's how I got my first dog, Fritz. Sweet. And she introduced me to a gentleman named Gary Engebretson, Firebird Kennels out of Stevens Point or Junction City, Wisconsin. Mm. And he kind of got me going. You know, he would train my dog. I was working in Chicago, didn't have time to train a dog in the city. So I would go back and forth from Wisconsin, learn how to work a dog, and started doing NAFTA and meeting a lot of other people in the upland world that way. So I would go up to the northern woods and do some grouse hunting and go out to South Dakota, do some pheasant hunting with my dog. And then in the wintertime, when I would go back to Louisiana, he was my guide dog. So he got a lot of water work too. So that got me hooked on Griffs, I think. And now I have two of them, one of Fritz's sons, and bred him a few times, about to do a fourth litter with a guy out of Arkansas. And so, yeah, that's kind of got into upland hunting.
You know, I've heard different breeds referred to as, you know, the Swiss Army knife of versatility. I've never heard the four-wheeler of versatility. Explain, you know, what appeals to you about Griffs and where's the four-wheeler come into play?
Sure. So I think just the versatility aspect, yeah, right? You know, they're really good water dogs. I hunt a lot of different variety of water where I'm at in Louisiana. My property is pretty diverse from a topography standpoint. So I have a lot of flooded timber that I hunt. I have fields, moist soil, vegetation fields. I have sloughs. And so where I hunt, it's not ideal to just have a dog that you can do line drills with. Mm-hmm. I want a dog that has the natural ability that you always talk about to use its nose and to really go find these birds. Because when you drop a bird in a button willow sloughs are thick, right? There's no way I'm going to know exactly where that bird is. Mm-hmm. I want that dog to use its natural ability to go hunt. And I found that a Griff was a good option for me in my hunting environment. And then I could also use that dog to do any upland hunting that I wanted. So that's what I mean by the four-wheeler.
Cool. You know, I'm going further into this conversation in dogs than I anticipated, but that's because I love talking dogs. So here's the northerner in me maybe coming out. I love the idea of going to Louisiana hunting a combo of Bob Whites and Woodcock. In, you know, being around water in Louisiana, the thought of that's got me spooked. And that's because of alligators.
Right.
So here's your opportunity to make sure no northerner ever goes to Louisiana because there's alligators everywhere. Or, you know, what's the reality? Like, how concerned are you being a guiding duck hunters with a Griff and hunting, you know, near alligators? How often do you see them? What's the level of concern?
Well, I mean, in the wintertime, I wouldn't say there's a terrible concern. I mean, we did take a 12-foot, 8-inch gator off our property a couple years ago. We took an 8-foot gator off. We get a few tags a year that we can go harvest a few gators. But, you know, during the wintertime, they're kind of dormant. I've been slapped on the leg a few times standing in water. Luckily, it was probably just a fish, but
I'm out.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too concerned in the wintertime. They're pretty much dormant by October, I would say. Once you start getting the first frost, like snakes and gators start to not be an issue.
Wow.
Yeah, I would say Florida and South Louisiana during duck season, I would be concerned about. So
good to note. All right, Ryan, thank you for waiting patiently. Ryan, the state coordinator for Quail Forever out of Arkansas, tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Wyoming, born and raised there. I'm from a little town called Rawlins, Wyoming. Hmm. It's south central in the state, and I grew up hunting and fishing with my grandfather. I mean, we did that every single weekend and on weeknights after school. We'd grab our fishing poles and go up the Bow River in this little town, Elk Mountain, Wyoming, where my grandpa lived. So hunting and fishing was kind of what we did in our way of life. And then I had my mind, I wanted to be a game warden, you know, because I think that's what all young wildlife students think.
And coming from Rawlins, Wyoming, you wanted to be Joe Pickett, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yes, in fact, it's funny you mentioned that. I have about half the CJ Box collection on my bookshelf downstairs.
I'm reading his brand new novel, Battle Mountain. I'm 3/4 of the way through it. I won't give up the ending, but when you said Rawlins, Wyoming, I'm like, there's no doubt in my mind he knows CJ Box and who Joe Pickett are.
Absolutely. I'll send you some pictures of my collection after this recording.
Cool.
But I went to the University of Wyoming and got a wildlife degree from there. And that took me into an internship with the Forest Service on the Forest Service's National Grasslands. I worked on Thunder Basin National Grassland in eastern Wyoming.
Hmm.
And a lot of people don't know that the Forest Service manages 21 national grasslands as well. And that was kind of my first entry into upland birds. I got to survey sage grouse and sharp-tail grouse. And there's no greater feeling than getting on a sharp-tailed grouse lek on a crisp morning. It was just incredible. And that led me to a graduate degree at the University of Colorado in partnership with the Forest Service. And I studied the ecology of the short grass prairie on Thunder Basin in eastern Wyoming. And then that led me to a private lands biologist job in southeast Colorado, where I worked with landowners. Primarily helping them improve their livestock operations for grassland birds. And so I got a lot of grazing and grazing land management experience in that job, and that led me right to Quail Forever in Arkansas as a grazing lands and grasslands coordinator. And that was in 2020. And just a few short years later, I took the role of Arkansas State Coordinator. And I love it here in Arkansas. It's a fantastic state, fantastic people, fantastic agricultural state. We got a growing team here in Arkansas. We've got about 25 staff on the ground, and we're really making a difference for quail conservation here in the state.
Do you miss the mountains of Wyoming, or is that the thing you miss the most?
I miss the mountains. I miss the prairie on eastern Wyoming. I miss the fishing. Someday I'll probably end up back, but I have realized that there's a lot to offer here in the South as well, you know.
What do you like most about Arkansas?
I like the people, and I love the ecosystems here, and, you know, just such a diversity in the plant and wildlife here in the state, and just the geology of Arkansas. It's really fascinating to me.
Cool. Well, that's a perfect transition for us to jump into the conversation of the ecosystem that does make up the Southeast, particularly as we're talking about Louisiana and Arkansas. And Jackson, I'm going to turn it back to you for you to kind of give us the overview of the state of things in Louisiana, Arkansas, when you're looking at trying to improve your geography for quail. As I mentioned in the opening, prescribed burning is the number one tool. So lead us to why prescribed burning is so important in the Southeast. Talk to us about the state of quail and state of habitat in the Southeast.
Sure. In the Southeast, fire was a huge part of nature's way of managing itself, right? In Louisiana, for example, I read this stat that said that all burnable acres in Louisiana historically were burned within 2 years, mm-hmm. a 2 year period. So that's a lot of fire, right? And we've really prevented that from happening. So forests are very overgrown. There's a lot of non-native and invasive species that are encroaching across the landscape. A lot of forest management practices have changed over the past few decades, so that the habitat that quail need just really isn't there, you know? And fire is a great tool in order to get that habitat back. Again, removing those invasive species that don't like fire, cleaning up the thatch and fuel load on forest floors, and letting that sunlight hit the forest floor to encourage our native species of vegetation, which is what quail needs, right? Mm-hmm.
So as we, Ryan, this one's for you, as we prepped for this conversation, which is probably... Yeah, you know, we started talking about doing a podcast together. It's 4 or 5 months ago. But what stands out to me is you and Jackson spent a lot of time trying to improve my understanding of basal area. So and that's, you know, as a Northwoods kid from the UP, I want basal area to find grouse and woodcock, you know, or I want high basal area with, you know, dense thickets of popples and alders. And that's different than what you're trying to do through prescribed fire. So for me, once again, to take us through it, but also for the listener, explain basal area, your goals, and how fire helps improve what you're after.
I will certainly try my hardest here. Basal area simply is a measurement of tree density in an area. That's kind of a basic way to think about it. Mm-hmm. So for quail, we want an open woodland or savanna style forest where sunlight is hitting the floor and allowing vegetation, herbaceous vegetation and shrubs to grow. And in a forest that's closed canopy with a high basal area, we are removing the desired habitat conditions that species like quail need. So I like to think of basal area in terms of walking up to a tree and at chest height, cutting that tree off and looking at the surface area of that tree. How much square feet is that one stump? And then times that by all of the square feet of the trees that you cut off at chest height over an area or a stand. How many square feet of trees are covering that stand? The lower square feet that we have, the more open the woodland is, the better habitat that is for upland wildlife.
And, you know, Jackson mentioned, you know, back in the day, prescribed fire being put on the landscape where you're at like every couple of years, and that's a critically important thing to keep in mind, right? Because, you know, with the heat, the humidity, the precipitation, the soil, things just grow really fast in Arkansas and Louisiana, don't they?
What I was talking about with that fire, Bob, real quick, is that fire was naturally on the landscape. I mean, people weren't doing that historically, right? You know, from lightning strikes or whatever was causing the fires. So they were essentially wildfires. They just weren't catastrophic because they happened so frequently that the fuel load was reduced and they didn't totally wipe out the forest.
So, but as a tool, if we could replicate that, you know, in a 2 to 3 year sequence, that's really valuable for quail, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do because, like you mentioned, in the South, things just grow so quickly. So we could, do a woodland thinning, but in 1 to 2 years, we have a whole bunch of tree saplings returning, and we could lose that woodland in a matter of 2 to 3 years without fire. So by applying prescribed fire, one of our most important tools that we have for management, on a 1 to 2 year rotation. That's how we're really going to maintain some of the work we're doing here in the South.
Cool. All right, let's bring Andrew into the conversation. And Andrew, tell us a little bit about your property or properties, generally where they're located, what they look like when you purchased them, and give us an overview of your goals.
Sure. So Jokes Bayou is an 1,800 acre piece of property in northeast Louisiana, approximately 10 miles from the Arkansas border. We have quite a few tributaries that run through it between Bayou Bartholomew, Jokes Bayou, and Bayou DeGlaise. Very diverse habitat. We have sloughs, we have a lake, we have moist soil impoundments. We have about 1,100 acres of loblolly pine, and we have some hardwood bottoms as well. A great mixture of habitat for all wildlife, really. My family started hunting this property in 2000. A friend of ours had assembled about 2,500 acres at the time, and my father's business leased this property until 2013 when we acquired really the duck habitat, which was 500 acres that was enrolled in a WRP track. I would say about one third was enrolled in a permanent easement, and then two thirds was enrolled in a 30-year easement. So that was my initial education on government contracts and how public and private partnerships work. It was in 2017 when I decided to take the 30-year easement track and enroll it into a permanent easement. After that, we signed a landowner contract and we redeveloped the entire 500-acre track, WRP track. And it was a 3-year process. We redeveloped everything from culvert systems to levees. We did a lot of work over that 3-year period.
And what was the impetus for the redevelopment?
So that tract of land had been developed in 1999. Engineering plans change. And Ducks Unlimited came in and did a huge engineering project on it, realized that there were some changes that they would like to make. We put in some spillways. We took out some levees. We put in new levees. A lot of the water control structures had been corroded, eroded away. Levee systems really were. My area is in a big bowl. We have Bayou Bartholomew on the west side that kind of wraps around our property that when that floods, we're a release for that bayou system. So I remember 1 year, it was January, we had a tremendous flood. I had about 500 decoys out there in the moist soil unit, and I had to get a John boat to go pick them all up. It was about 8 feet above where the blinds were. So just think about that, and that happens almost every year where we get all of this extra water coming in as a relief for the bayou systems around us. So a lot of work needed to be done to improve what had already been established that over time just eroded away.
Gotcha.
Through that whole relationship, I started getting more involved with what other programs could I do through the NRCS or FSA office. That's how I got to know Jackson, Scott Breedlove, and some others. Austin Klaus has been really great to work with as well. And it was Austin and Scott that actually started talking to me about what other programs in really my my loblolly pine stance that we could start doing. And the first one was the CSP program, which we're in our fifth year. And there's a lot of similarities, and I think Jackson can speak to this a little bit more, but RCPP is very similar to the CSP program. But what it really entails is exactly what we're talking about, opening up stands, doing prescribed burns, pollinator seeding throughout your property over a five-year period, and hopefully longer than that.
So these guys, Jackson and Ryan, probably know I despise the acronym soup that our world, you know, I worked in professional baseball before coming to work at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And I thought there were a lot of acronyms in baseball, you know, RBIs and ERA, and then the advent of sabermetrics. And it was like, oh my gosh, we got WHIP and all these new acronyms, but it's no match for the world of conservation. There's just, everybody's trying to create new acronyms every day. It just drives me bonkers. So, you know, I'll turn it over to Jackson, knowing that you're going to talk about some acronyms here, CSP, RCPP. But as you do, so what I want you to do is explain what you're looking at when you see Andrew's property and some of the ways that you can help him achieve his goals in some of the acronyms you're going to talk about, but explain those acronyms to the listener too, so they get an understanding of what connects to what.
Oh boy.
yeah, the biggest challenge of the week, isn't it?
Now I got to translate our Greek verbiage to the nation. So the programs that we work with are funded under the United States Farm Bill, right? So they're in the USDA bubble. And NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, is our partners on a lot of our positions, not just in Louisiana and Arkansas, but across the country. Yep. So those programs, those Farm Bill programs that NRCS and FSA help administer, we won't get into FSA side. We'll stick with CSP, the Conservation Stewardship Program, EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and RCPP, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. So those are the three big ones coming out of NRCS offices. Basically, what they're doing is if a landowner comes in and is asking us for help, they have these what we call resource concerns, or RCs. If wildlife is one of their resource concerns, then one of our biologists is going to get involved and basically do a field visit and interview that landowner and collect some resource inventory on the property. What's growing there? What is the current state of that property, and what does that landowner want to do? Again, if wildlife is a resource concern, then we talk about things like, okay, well, under these programs, we can do a forest thinning, or we can do herbicide treatments, chemical brush control, pollinator habitat seedings, prescribed fire, all that stuff. And there's cost share for that under these programs. The RCPP is, like was kind of suggested, is one of those like CSP on steroids, right? Mm-hmm. It's like you can do the things we're doing under RCPP with a CSP or EQIP contract. But what the RCPP is it's a program that is partner-led, partner-driven, partner-implemented, right? And there are certain requirements under RCPP that makes you eligible. Two of those requirements in Louisiana and Arkansas is thinning to or below 60 square foot basal area and putting fire on those acres. Those are our two requirements to get RCPP acres on your property.
When you talk about RCPP, and it allows you to decrease the number of trees in a given area, right? Reduce the basal area.
Okay.
That is, to my ears, exactly what we're talking about when we want to create quail habitat. It's allowing the connection between RCPP funding project for a landowner to do prescribed burning to create quail for habitat. Seems like the perfect tool in the Southeast. Is that an accurate assessment of what you look at from a conservation planner's perspective?
Yeah. So after when we're ranking those applications, you know, an application for 5 acres in the middle of not good habitat probably isn't the best spot to expect to have a big impact on quail, right? But if you've got bigger acres, or you've got acres that are near a quail population, a self-sustaining quail population, it's a great tool in order to manage your property to bring quail back onto your property. And we're seeing really great results through this RCPP and the other programs through NRCS that we're doing the same kind of work. Within 3 to 4 years, we're having landowners calling us saying, "I heard quail on my place this morning." You know, so we're seeing the results. It just takes some time.
You know, Andrew, you talked a lot about your property and the wetland plan, and you know, working with our friends at Ducks Unlimited and trying to make it, you know, really solid piece of property for waterfowl. Tell us about your goals when it comes to the uplands. What were you trying to accomplish on your land for whether it be quail or woodcock?
Yeah, so we enrolled 1,100 acres into the CSP program back in 2020. The goal was to bring those bobwhite and turkey populations back that many years ago were pretty prominent in the area. Mm-hmm. Today, there are a lot of turkey hunters that have to go far, far miles away to go turkey hunting. And as an owner of a hunting lodge, I want to provide my members with the ability to hunt year round, you know, whether it be turkey, quail, ducks, whitetail. And I kind of want to make an oasis for wildlife. As I started to learn more about what the benefits of this were, I mean, just take, for example, the whitetail hunting. You know, I used to have feeders out there for whitetail, and I've gone away from that since for a couple of years now. Because all I would see were raccoons eating all my corn. And as I was talking to Jackson actually, I think this was 2 years ago, Jackson, when we first met, we were having conversation about what I think I asked you, like, why can we not get predator control programs? And you said, "Andrew, your program that you're enrolled in is exactly that. It's predator control, because as you do your thinning, you open up the canopy, you open up the timber stands, you're actually eliminating the habitat for those predators to thrive." And I that's when the light bulb clicked for me, really, is, okay, if I want to have the wildlife that I want to hunt and thrive on my property to be sustainable, I need to do these certain programs to allow for that to occur. So, you know, when we started in 2020, we had 1,100 acres. That was about 180 basal area. Today, we have that 1,100 acres. About 95% of that is now at a 55 basal. We've done prescribed burns on all of it at this point. And, you know, we do a 2 to 3 year rotation on our burn plan. We just finished burning 175 acres last week. So, and we started to see a lot of turkey, and we started to hear quail and see some quail. So I know the plan is working.
Yeah.
And, I'm glad that we're seeing these results, because now we can have this conversation and get more landowners in our area that aren't taking advantage of these programs to start really looking into it.
Can you describe it? You said the basal area had been, did you say 180?
It was probably around 180. Our trees on average were, our stands were probably around 17 years of age.
Okay.
Each, you know, typical timber management in Louisiana for loblolly pine, you have a 15-year thinning, you have a 20-year thinning, and then you have a 30-year clear cut. So a lot of this property that we had acquired back in 2021 had never been thinned. And so now today that stand's probably around 20 years old and just now getting a first thinning. So I would say this, the biggest thing I've noticed in, you know, traveling the Southeast, like from Georgia to Southern Arkansas to Louisiana, certain states have really managed their pine successfully and others haven't. Like if you go down to South Arkansas, if say you're driving from Morehouse Parish, Louisiana to Texarkana, Arkansas, you're going to drive through some of the most beautiful pine I had ever seen. And it's, you know, the state of Arkansas's, I want to say it's their test plantation. And when I saw that a few years ago, I was like, this is exactly what I want my property to look like. And I was actually driving down the highway, taking photos with my phone as I'm driving by it and sending it to all my members saying, hey guys, in a few years, this is what we're going to have. Just be patient.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're just about there. And, you know, I'm excited for like the next 5 to 10 years and seeing what other, you know, improvements we can continue to do. Because, you know, wildlife property or property just in general, it's like a living organism, right? It's constantly changing and evolving and you're always having to manage it. And I wouldn't be able to do this on my own if I wasn't probably enrolled in a program. And this is probably why a lot of landowners in the state of Louisiana don't do it. It's because they're not taking advantage of these programs and these partnerships. You know, without Jackson or Austin to come to my property and educate me on this, I probably wouldn't be doing it and it would probably be hurting my property. So that's why I want to do it. It's because I see the benefit. I want to enhance my property. I want to continue to manage the property in the best way possible.
Yeah, right on. Ryan, you've patiently been sitting there listening. What questions or what comments should I be asking that I haven't asked, or anything you'd like to add to the conversation so far?
I do want to say, you know, for Andrew, I really, really appreciate that answer. And, you know, the landowner is the most important partner that we have in quail conservation, especially in the South, in the Southeast U.S. Without landowners like Andrew enrolling into these programs and implementing this conservation at the level that we're asking them to try to protect, you know, the last remaining populations of quail, we wouldn't be where we're at today. So really it's landowners and their important partnership that's helping us drive this home.
Yeah, go ahead, Andrew.
And one point to that, you know, in my part of the country, a lot of these programs are focused around timber property, right? And I think that's where the struggle is. Because a lot of landowners with primarily pine, they're looking at it as a merchant style thinning operation where it's a source of revenue and income for them on an annual basis. So when I look at that as, you know, putting my real estate hat on, you know, that is my income stream. That is my tenant, essentially, are my trees that I get my rent checks from on an annual basis, right? Now, while that's all good, there are other important aspects of this land that come into play, like conservation. A lot of owners don't look at it that way, and I think these landowners need to become educated on how the government is helping subsidize landowners because they are not doing merchant style thinning. I would say, you know, there's two ways I look at real estate. You have an income producing property that generates a certain yield on an annual basis. However, you also have the appreciation of that asset over time, right? So that combines into your, you know, internal IRR, you know, on your yield on your asset.
Yeah.
I would say because of these programs and the enhancements that I've done, my basis, my yield on the appreciation of my asset has improved greatly. While I'm still getting revenue off the timber harvesting, while also getting income from these government programs, which I think is very important. And, you know, it was frustrating. A couple of years ago, I got asked by University of Arkansas Monticello to come to Monroe for a discussion on public-private partnership. And unfortunately, I was the only one that showed up. And so I didn't get to really provide other landowners with my experience with this. And hopefully this is what this podcast is going to help provide. Landowners have to understand that there are ways in which their goals from an income standpoint, as well as someone who cares about their land as well from a conservation aspect, to really combine the two aspects of land ownership from a monetary aspect and conservation aspect, and make it a win-win for them.
So as I hear you guys talking about these programs in the Southeast, you know, I can't help but compare and contrast Pheasant Country and CRP. And I think about Pheasant Country and CRP, to me, is super visual and super easy to understand. You know, it's the Conservation Reserve Program. That looks like the 80 acres of diverse mix of grasses and forbs where the pheasants grow. And it may be on a hillside around a cattail slough. It's like, you know, that age-old slogan, farm the best, conserve the rest. And it's, as a bird hunter, very visual to me to understand, or as a landowner, it's like, that's tough to farm. If I could enroll that and protect it and get a payment from the federal government and create some wildlife benefits, that's visually and mentally, it all adds up to me. When I think about the Southeast and some of the other programs, it's a little bit more of a challenge. You know, the basal area, what I'm driving at here is visual, right? Like trees, not so good, right? You know, you want less trees, more sunlight shining through, and more it increases the quality of habitat for quail. I get that. But then you open up the acronym soup of CSP, RCPP, EQIP, and what all those do are different things. But ultimately, if we can boil it all down, it's trying to create more grassland habitat in a ecosystem that is trying to battle the grassland ecosystem, right? They want, trees want to grow, things want to suppress the ability for just grasses to maintain with the absence of fire. Did I explain that right, Ryan? What's your take on the visual comparison between CRP and what you guys are trying to accomplish?
Yeah, well, a couple points there. You know, CRP and then RCPP, EQIP, CSP. All of those are federal incentive programs that are coming out of the Farm Bill. And all of those programs are intended to improve natural resource concerns and conservation, whether it be for wildlife or soil health, water quality, plant quality. All of those programs are coming out of the Farm Bill and intended to be implemented on private lands for private landowners, particularly landowners that have working land, so they have some sort of forested operation or livestock operation or row crop operation. You know, the idea is to keep working lands working while improving conservation measures through all of these programs. And I think what like Jack and I and what we've heard Andrew talk about is so much of what we're trying to do in the South and in Southeast is take an ecological approach to these management practices. We look at Arkansas and Louisiana, we see a lot of forest. And there's no doubt that historically there was forest in Louisiana and Arkansas, but there was also a lot of grassland. And grassland that was open, grassland that didn't have trees, grassland that was savanna, that had maybe just a handful of trees on any given landscape. And then there was open woodland. And all of those are grasslands in their own right. And then there were also systems that were true, more closed canopy forest. So we have to be able to identify historically where those systems would have occurred and then use these cost share programs through the Farm Bill to try to return back to that historical state. That's really what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, and Jackson, explain, connect the dots to the Arkansas Louisiana Conservation Delivery Network, because that's a big picture approach to do exactly what Ryan's talking about, isn't it?
So, when we're talking about, quail or other upland species of wildlife that we're trying to help, you have to look at the landscape, right? And fill in the gaps between pockets of good habitat. How can we connect those two pockets? So, it's really important to keep that context of the landscape in mind. And that's really what kind of what the CDN, the Conservation Delivery Network, between Louisiana and Arkansas is doing. Think of it kind of as like a business board where you have or a co-op where you have leadership from multiple different businesses come together and say, okay, we're all doing good things for the community by ourselves. How can we make sure we're working together? So that's what the CDN is. It's folks in leadership positions from several federal and state agencies and NGOs and partners. We get together a couple times a year and just talk about the work we're doing and work that needs to be done and how the work I'm Quail Forever is doing is going to benefit the state agency and and how we can partner up to make sure that we're not kind of conflicting in our conservation projects and really working together as one, because we all want the same thing.
Sure.
Like Ryan said, we're trying to restore these acres to their historical functions, to benefit wildlife.
And how many, do you have rough number of groups that are involved in that effort in your two states?
So, what, Ryan? A dozen, maybe?
Yeah, a dozen, if not 2 dozen, you know.
So there's a lot of interest, and I understand that overall the group is trying to implement the Open Pine Regional Conservation Partnership Program. So it's the Open Pine RCPP that you're trying to deliver through all these groups working together through prescribed burning to open up the canopy. And not everybody is focused as much as we are on quail habitat. There's other resource benefits that other groups are trying to achieve as well, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And one important thing that we're trying to do with the Open Pine RCPP is create these habitats on private lands, with the partnership of a private landowner just like Andrew, and then have these sites that we can bring neighboring landowners to, so that they can see it and then get a visual in their mind of what they want their property to look like. And so that's the whole idea behind this is if we're going to get more landowners involved, they have to go look and see something that's currently working, and that gives them the ability to visualize it on their property. And yeah, these sites are, we're selling this as open pine because that's the historical ecological function of these systems. And it's benefiting bobwhite quail, but it's also benefiting white-tailed deer. It's benefiting turkeys. It's benefiting the monarch butterfly, mm-hmm. which is a very, you know, important species right now in today's environment. It's benefiting pollinator species like bumblebees and just important insects. So, you know, we're benefiting a whole suite of species here, plants and wildlife, by what we're trying to do.
Right on. Jackson, you wanted to add on?
Yeah. In like I said, we're looking at it at a landscape context, right? Because we get a lot of questions, you know, well, that's great, but I don't own property up there. I hunt public land. How is you helping Andrew on his land helping me? And which is, you know, a valid point, right. But like I said, you got to look at that the context of the landscape. What we're doing, we have a list of species that are of conservation concern, meaning they're on the threatened and endangered list, or they're being considered to be placed on that list. What we're doing isn't creating better hunting opportunity for these landowners. I mean, we are, but a lot of the landowners are telling us, I have no interest of killing a quail. I would just like to see them on my property. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is really trying to turn the tides of those declines in those populations. And again, like Ryan said, it goes beyond quail. It's impacting turkey, red-cockaded woodpecker, Bachman sparrow, Louisiana pine snake, all these species that are not doing good, right? And in effect, if we change the landscape as a whole back to what it was, that is going to benefit public land hunters.
Right, because whatever the turkeys, the deer, the quail aren't only going to stay within the confines right. of those borders. They might if it's the best habitat, but beyond that, right, they'll end up on public lands. I want to be respectful of your guys' time. You've shared a lot with me. I want to move us to closing thoughts and ask you each for, you know, what you want listeners to leave as a takeaway with. Before I do that, Jackson, if folks that are listening, landowners that are listening in Louisiana, Arkansas, if they're listening, they want to learn more. What do they do? What step do they take to learn more? Is it simple as going to a USDA service center? Or is there other routes you would recommend?
Yeah. Reach out for help. There are thousands of conservation workers across the country. So even if you're listening to this and you're not in Louisiana, but you own property and you have management goals for that property, reach out and try and get help, whether that's from a state agency, a federal agency like NRCS, or an NGO like Quail Forever. We're here. You just got to come and knock on the door and say, hey, I need your help, you know. And conservation's expensive. This work is expensive. And in many cases, there's going to be financial support to help landowners achieve their management goals.
Right. Listeners can go to pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org. Under the conservation tab, at the very bottom, there's a find a biologist tab. Click on that and you can type in zip code and it'll tell you the closest biologist we have on the team to wherever you are, whether that's Louisiana, Arkansas, or, you know, South Carolina. All right, Ryan, give us your closing thought for this episode.
Well, my closing thoughts are, you know, the importance of the Farm Bill and the incentive programs that come out of that. You know, you mentioned CRP. We've talked about RCPP and EQIP. They're programs that are directly administered on private lands to help the private landowner reach their conservation goals. And I just think that's so important. And then, you know, the private landowner and the important partnership that they bring to the table. You know, I think that that's invaluable. and that's really how we're going to move the needle for bringing quail back in the South and Southeast.
Yeah, right on. Well, let's go to our featured landowner guest. Andrew, what's your closing thought as we wrap up today's conversation about your property and your beloved part of the world?
Yeah, I just think that, you know, the reason why I do it is because I think as a landowner, we have a responsibility to be stewards of your land. And I think that the NRCS, the FSA office, the Department of Agriculture as a whole has a lot of resources that landowners can benefit so that they can be that good steward of the land. I just hope that our listeners will take this to heart and actually go explore these opportunities, because for me personally, I've only seen the benefit. I've enjoyed learning from these resources that are at these government agencies, and it's only improved my land. There's really been no downfall to the enrolling in these programs. So,
yeah, I thought one of the most powerful points of our conversation is you talking about the two-pronged way of thinking of the economic benefits of property. Yeah, there is the here and the now of the every year yield, whether that's timber, corn, or cotton, right? You got to pay your mortgage, and there's the money that's being produced on an annual basis. But conservation does also improve that long-term value of a property. And, you know, that also can help put kids through college or, you know, make sure that the family is able to stay on the property for a long time. So I thought that was a really, really extraordinarily powerful point. So thank you for sharing that with us. Jackson, you were the catalyst for this conversation. You were the instigator saying, let's talk Arkansas, Louisiana on the podcast. What did we meet your goals? What's your final thought?
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. Thanks for setting this up, Bob and Ryan for helping, and Andrew for jumping on and sharing your story with us. My thought with this was, you know, as conservation professionals, we can do as much outreach and field tours and everything and talk to the public about what we need to be doing until we're blue in the face. But I think having landowners come out and tell their stories about the work that they're doing and the impact that these programs are making carries a lot of weight. So thank you, Andrew, for doing this. Grasslands are incredibly underappreciated and severely abused and neglected. It's really sad. We're losing grassland acres every day. And in the past 50 years, we've lost like 50% of our grassland birds. And it's projected by 2050 that we lose the remaining 50% of those remaining grassland birds. That's a problem, you know, and when so much of the country is privately owned, like Andrew said, when you own property, you have a responsibility to help manage that property for wildlife or water quality, soil quality, whatever. So I think if all landowners in the country set 5 to 10% of their acres aside for wildlife habitat and managed it for wildlife habitat, the impact would be huge. I have a good friend that lives in Denver, and he mulched his yard. He just killed his yard and put mulch down and planted some native species of vegetation. And like a year later, he texted me. He's like, dude, I have morels growing in my yard. It's like, what? Downtown Denver, you're picking morels out of your yard, you know? And I own 1 acre here in Louisiana. And last year, I took a tenth of an acre of my grass and just nuked it with herbicide to convert it to pollinator habitat. Mm-hmm. Well, this past winter during the woodcock migration, I had a woodcock hang out in my backyard for a couple days, probing around in that soil, you know, because turf grass is gone, so it's just wet soil. So that tenth of an acre was enough to provide that bird an opportunity to hold up for a couple days, rest, refuel, and then go about his migration. So do something, anything of any size is better than nothing, you know. Earn that title of conservationist. Do something. So I guess as I climb down off my soapbox, my closing thought, my official closing thought is kill your lawn, plant natives.
Well said. And I think you've come up with a new marketing angle for us. If we can replicate whatever it was that your buddy in Denver did to create morel mushrooms, we will have a conservation gold mine. Because those are delicious, no matter where you live.
That's what I told him. I said, where'd you get that mulch? I'm going to have to buy some of that.
Oh, fellas, thank you very much for the generosity of your time and your stories. Andrew Wiesman, Ryan Parker, Jackson Martini, really appreciate your insights, advice, and stories today. Folks, thanks for listening to this episode of On the Wing Podcast. I'm Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Just make sure there's no gators chasing them.